Good morning and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work that's being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. Good morning once again. I'm Joel Katz. And joining me this week is Dr. Yasser Gilani, skull base and cerebrovascular neurosurgeon at JFK Neuroscience Institute, currently serving as director at the Center for Skull Base and Pituitary Surgery at Hackensack Meridian JFK University Medical Center and assistant professor at Hackensack University School of Medicine. Got a lot going on. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Appreciate you being on the program. We're going to talk about, the skull base is what we're talking about today specifically. So I guess to make it a little clearer for those listening and for me, what type of conditions usually would require surgery of the skull base?
Sure. So just by way of introduction, if you were to consider the brain as a car, the skull base would be the undercarriage where most important things lie and most important mechanisms of the car meander. However, by virtue of that, it also happens to be the most inaccessible part of the cranial cavity. Most vessels and other important structures called cranial nerves happen to reside in the skull base, and thereby specialists of this area learn to deal with pathologies that encompass both the bone, the nervous structures, the vessels, and the brain itself. Most tumors that are synonymous with skull base surgeries are either of the anterior fossa, which is the forwardmost placed area of the skull base. There's also a middle fossa, which is in the middle, as the name would imply, and then a posterior fossa. The anterior fossa surgeries involve tumors originating mostly in the pituitary, given their frequency. Mm-hmm. Pituitary tumors come dime a dozen. They're quite common. Some of them are not even diagnosed till postmortem on autopsies. But some, as a matter of fact, do become hormonically active, or they present with compression problems of the optic nerves and thereby result in problems with vision, and that's how they come to fore and they seek surgical attention. Meningiomas are benign tumors, luckily, that happen to also be found on the skull base and in high frequency, as are other miscellaneous tumors of the skull, of the skull base itself, and those include chordomas and more seriously chondrosarcomas. And in addition to that, by virtue of spending most time in that area, surgery of the brainstem oftentimes is also relegated to skull base, wherein the actual collection of cables that derives information from the brain before it transitions to the spinal cord, they traverse a part of the brain that is synonymous with the skull base, and thereby specialists treating pathologies are also trained to treat brainstem lesions that are otherwise prohibitively inaccessible.
So surgery of the skull base, to be clear, is not brain surgery, but sometimes it involves surgery of the brain. Did I hear that correctly?
It is a brain surgery indeed, because most structures are ultimately connected to the brain, as are vessels, okay, nerves, and the bone itself in direct opposition. And oftentimes getting to a part of the brain that may harbor a tumor involves an approach that goes through the skull base.
So could you explain again, maybe it's just not clear to me, that what encompasses the skull base?
The skull base is the floor of the cranial cavity upon which the brain sits.
Okay.
A lot of nerves that originate in the brain at the bottom happen to exit the skull through the skull base. And all pathologies involving that area come under the jurisdiction of a skull base surgeon.
Okay, so it's the bottom of the skull. I was picturing like basically where the skull meets the spine, but it's the whole bottom of the skull.
It's the whole, yeah. Yes, indeed. It's the bottom of the cranial cavity.
Okay, and that's the hardest place to, it's really challenging to treat tumors of the skull base, because as you mentioned in the beginning, it's very hard to get to. And to use, you know, like a car example again, there's certain parts of a car in the engine that are just very difficult to get to, and that could cause other issues if you're not careful.
Yes, indeed. And as one surgeon had had posited, the brain wasn't designed to be easily serviced, much less at the base of itself. It's considered a 1967 Stingray. It's incredibly hard to get to the base of it.
Oh, now I know that it's hard to get to the base of a 67 Stingray as well.
It is challenging. It takes quite a bit of creativity and innovation to get in there without harming the brain that sits on top of it.
Right. So how do we go about this? I mean, give me an example of something when you a tumor of the skull base and what the process is once it's diagnosed. From start to finish, from the time I walk into your office, or I guess I'm referred to you from another doctor, I would imagine, and then where do we go from there?
Well, I'm glad you segued into that. It makes for a perfect transition into how exactly your skull-based lesions approach. Now, take the example of my dear friend, Mr. Katz, coming into clinic, typically to his primary care physician, saying, I've been low on energy lately, and I don't feel like doing anything. And at the same time, I'm developing these purple lines on my body. And, you know, as part of your workup, you were found to have an elevated titer of a particular hormone. Seeing this and being alarmed by it, the primary care physician refers you to an endocrinologist. The endocrinologist completes all the basic hormone checks for the rest of the hormones and realizes that you're secreting high titers compared to normal variants from what might be your pituitary gland. And so thereafter, they naturally ask for an MRI of the brain. Once an MRI of the brain happens, lo and behold, they find oftentimes a mass centered between the two optic nerves in this place called the cella, which is the cella translates into saddle in Greek, and that's where the pituitary gland sits, and tumors of the pituitary thereby are tumors of the skull base. One way, and in fact, which has become standard of care, to approach tumors of this particular area of the skull base is through the nose, actually. And so after having experienced significant complications perioperatively for years in the 1950s and 60s, one very smart neurosurgeon by the name of Walter Dandy thought, well, maybe this part of the skull base can be accessed safely through the nose. And so thereafter, he laid foundation for what became the burgeoning field of endonasal, so through the nostril surgery, through the nose, onto the skull base, and basically is an incisionless, at least for as far as incisions go externally on the skin, surgery that involves placing an endoscope, a small tube, and drilling right through that endoscopic pathway to reveal part of that tumor. It's resected, it's patched back together from inside with some reconstructive material, and that's the end of it. Typically, you recover from surgery on day two. Hopefully, you go home, you follow up with your endocrinologist, and thereafter follow up with me in 2 to 3 weeks and potentially find a cure. Luckily for all of us, skull-based tumors, most of the time, and I have to emphasize the word most, are of benign nature, meaning that your surgery and the skill with which you carry it out could potentially be curative, and thereby the impetus is on the surgeon to do a good job to resect as much as is possible without causing a complication. Just given the fact that these benign lesions tend to not grow if they're resected in totality. And resecting them in totality requires a lot of time, a lot of skill, and a lot of innovation in the form of newer technologies, most of which we've been gradually adopting here at JFK University Medical Center.
Yeah, you talked about so this is what they were doing in the 50s. I can't imagine having a surgery, as difficult and challenging it is today. And then you mentioned the doctor that came up through the nasal cavity. Is that a process that's still used today? And does it make it easier? Because we were talking about how challenging it is, but the way you described it through the nose seemed rather simple. Not for me, but for someone with your experience.
Indeed. Now, in lieu of the fact that skull-based surgery typically involves a lot of hard work and countless hours on working on cadavers to figure out what the best approach would be, people became creative and innovative. Now, an endoscope, which is a rod-mounted lens, and gives you visualization in deep recesses or visualization around the corner that otherwise would require you another 6 hours of surgery to take off a large part of the skull and look underneath. These mm-hmm. newer technologies have definitely made it easier. However, there's a learning curve that's a bit steeper. And, you know, the indications and the reach of endoscopic surgery or minimally invasive neurosurgery in general has over the years been expanding significantly, wherein now we can resect tumors in far-off corners with corridors that involve least retraction of the brain, and that's an important part. We tend to respect brain more than we do bone, so we drill out a bone just to get to the brain and not have to disturb the brain much. Sneak in, sneak out, have the tumor out, and thereby hope that a perfect result ensues.
Enter through the skull wherever the location is where the tumor is located.
That is absolutely right, yes.
Yeah, you don't want to be fishing around between the brain and the skull.
Yes, indeed. Now, you've got that absolutely right. Now, most aneurysms, by the way, also tend to reside at the skull base. So whenever you hear an aneurysm surgery, more times than not, it does involve some principles and facets of skull base approaches to get there, especially deep-seated aneurysms like basilar tip aneurysms, which hitherto couldn't be operated upon just given how complex the area to get them. We're talking, you know, scores and scores of vessels and nerves that are transversing your corridor to this particular area, any of which disturbance or even violation of any nerve or even vessel can have potentially fatal complications or significantly disfiguring complications. So the stakes are high, and therefore it requires a fair amount of training, both in the form of didactic training in neurosurgical residency and fellowships, and laboratory-based cadaveric training, wherein you practice your approaches before you actually go into an operation and operate on one of your patients. Now, that brings me into the fact that more recently, though, we have developed remarkable platforms to practice your surgery virtually using VR, which is virtual reality, or augmented reality-based platforms. And those allow you to superimpose a patient unique pathology in the form of an MRI scan, render it into a 3D holographic image, put on a VR headset, and basically practice your surgery the night before. It gives you a fair amount of familiarity. Every brain is different, and within every brain, every tumor is different. And to understand the vicinity of the tumor, how the tumor evolved. Because if you look at it at face value, tumor surgery is a reversal of how tumors evolve. It's you're attempting to involute the tumor, either by resecting, but getting back to that anatomy of what it was before the tumor arose. And so understanding the anatomy of the pathology in addition to normal anatomy is also of paramount importance.
So when you're practicing with the VR the night before, are you practicing on an actual image of the actual brain and skull base of the patient that you'll be operating on the next morning?
Yes, indeed. It all starts within the clinic itself. Within that clinic visit, we bring in our system into the patient's room to show them what exactly we're dealing with. And it, for us as human beings, a perception of depth does help greatly appreciate the understanding of what a tumor. If I were to show you a two-dimensional profile of a tumor, you may look at it, you may understand where it is, north, south, east, west, superior, inferior. But if I showed you the same tumor in a 3D hologram of the VR headset, the degree of appreciation is exponentially more intricate. And the fidelity of you understanding and this is standard practice with us at JFK University Medical Center in the neuroscience department. Whenever there are complex tumors like this, we bring in the VR headset and our system, and we allow the patient to look at the tumor that they bear or harbor within their brain, and to give them snippets as to which way we approach them. For instance, to give them a dry run of going through the nose and drilling them out of bone and finding the carotid arteries on either side of a tumor, for instance, and thereby resecting it. And giving that dry run just instills a certain degree of confidence in the patient as to what they expect is going to happen to them. And then the night before, the surgeon himself, and after thoroughly going over every single slice of the imaging, dons on the very same headset and rehearses the operation, trying to anticipate any difficulties that might arise.
So the patient sees exactly what you're going to be doing, the drilling, everything.
In 3D, yes, indeed.
In 3D, yeah. And what kind of reactions do you get from that? I would think that some might be terrified in seeing, wouldn't want to see it, I should say. They might be like, I don't want to see that. You just do what you got to do.
That's a very valid comment that you made. Now, different people obviously fall on a different side of bell curve as to curiosity. Mm-hmm. There are different Freudian mechanisms. So I would describe the diagnosis of a tumor as a very important event in someone's life. Some, it is a sign of impending doom. And there's obviously a degree of grief that is associated, even if it's a benign tumor. There's a lot of trepidation, a lot of worry as to how this might turn out. Different people have different defense mechanisms. Some people respond with humor. Some people actually respond with rationalization. So they would much rather understand what is going on, and that helps allay the fear a bit. And so I would say in my practice, about 80% of the patients who I see, probably even almost 9 out of 10, I should rather say, do want to look at the tumor in 3D, do want to know where exactly it would go through, do want to know how big the incision would be or what potential complications I might get to know or get to encounter during the case itself, rather than just be put in the dark. And you'd be surprised at how many people actually want to see their tumor, take a picture on their cell phone, or, they really are interested in, as they say, the anatomy of the pathology within their brains. It's a very, very, very intriguing phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I would too. I would want to see everything, but I know, and I have family members I know would not want that. They wouldn't even want that if they were going to the dentist. You know, they don't want to see anything.
I see.
So, yeah.
Again, it's very, very intriguing, but that's what we encounter here at JFK.
Now, do you use robotics? I don't know that you've mentioned that yet, and I know this is an operation where you need a very steady hand.
True. As much as robotics, the advent of robotics has revolutionized surgeries in some ways, unfortunately, the degree of dexterity that would be demanded of any particular robotic mechanism within your surgery far exceeds what we currently have. And so while there still are efforts to integrate both, AI-based robotics and robotics standalone, the haptic feedback of touching tissue with a very fine instrument with corridors that at max are 2 to 3 millimeter diameters really requires a great degree of, feedback and constant oscillatory circuitry to understand, whether anything is going wrong, because, one small move, one small tear can rip a vessel or it can damage parts of your brain that may result in catastrophic consequences. So we haven't achieved, but I wouldn't be surprised if during my lifetime there will be robotic systems that are, they exist for general surgery procedures where, dare I say, the stakes are relatively lower, but just given the small quarters that we work in, robotics still have to come a long way, and both in terms of feedback and planning to accomplish the surgery all by itself. But as I said, again, there are constant efforts, and I would foresee that happening sometime in the future.
Are most of these surgeries you do, the skull-based surgeries, are they very similar? Or is you said how everyone's brain is different. Are they all totally different? Or do you have, being the surgeon, is there somewhat of a routine involved in any way?
Quite the opposite, actually. And that's one reason why what attracted me about skull base. I initially thought that I would become a pediatric neurosurgeon. My dad was a pediatric neurosurgeon. And, after having children of my own, I found it psych-taxing when I was training at Boston Children's Hospital in pediatrics.
Right.
But in general, skull-based pathology is as varied as it gets. Probably the most varied subspecialty within neurosurgery, given how you have an entire geographical area on the skull base with a litany of different structures, nerves, muscles, bone, vessels, brainstem structures itself. It's just innumerable. And thereby, within these three fossae that I had mentioned earlier, the anterior cranial fossa, the middle cranial fossa, the posterior cranial fossa, all these areas harbor completely different pathologies. So it wouldn't be uncommon for me to be operating on the back of a head for a tumor called, let's say, acoustic neuroma, arising from, you know, the vestibular nerve or the balance nerve. And, you know, on a different day of the week, of the same week, I'll be operating through the nose, doing a couple pituitaries at the same time, and the third time, maybe clipping an aneurysm if that were to come through the ED. So it is a very varied field, and the pathologies are varied as well. And I have not yet felt the sense of monotony, just given the degree of variability with what pathology you encounter.
Of the three examples you gave, is there one that's easier than the other, if I could use the word easier?
We, you know, from a very early age in our relative infancy and residency, have been taught one cardinal rule of neurosurgery. There is no such thing as an easy case.
That's why I hesitated. Yeah.
Even the most simplest of cases can go wrong in unimaginable ways. The dogma that neurosurgeons operate by is every single case is just as complex as the most complex case they've ever done. And for that particular patient, regardless of the complexity in conventional terms, that surgery on that particular day for that particular patient is the most important event that that human being will be going through in a long time in their life. And to make sure that you're dedicated, it's incumbent upon the surgeon to make sure that that day goes well, whether complex, simple, short, or long. And, you know, that's the way we typically train nationally in the U.S.
Yeah, it's good. Well, it's good that if nothing is monotonous in what you do, nothing is routine, it certainly helps that no one is going to take anything for granted as when it comes to the surgery.
That is very true. Now, also, I may add, we are in advanced phases of establishing a skull-based laboratory here at JFK. We've been assigned space to set up some might call mini ORs that will be self-equipped with donated equipment, including a microscope, a surgical endoscope, and then we procure cadaveric specimens of people who very generously donated, you know, their bodies to science to both educate residents and fellows about surgical anatomy and to optimize approaches to these areas that involve a lot of dexterity, such that with more practice, it's generally you refer to the Malcolm Gladwell rule of 10,000 hours to get a single movement right. And, you know, given the litany of movements you're required to do a skull-based case, having a cadaveric lab for any skull-based program in the country is absolutely indispensable. And I'm lucky that, you know, with the support of our administration here at JFK University Medical Center, and given their academic vision, we're able to establish that.
Dr. Yasir Gilani, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been very educational. I've never spoken about this before on this show, and it sounds so difficult. It's amazing what you do. It really is.
No, thank you, Joel. And please do stop by at some point. We can go over things on a VR headset just for your...
Oh, that would be good. I just hope I don't stop by because I need to.
I hope so. I hope you never need me, but it was a delight talking to you.
You as well.
And God bless you.
You too.
Thank you.
For more information, go to jfkmc.org, or for a podcast of this show, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health is brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. We'll talk again next week.